So those of you who were at the 10 o'clock service last week know that I changed my topic for today. Originally, I was going to finish the Joshua series today, and while I was kind of preparing my lessons, I got a really strong sense from the Lord that he didn't want me to do that. He wanted me to preach on freedom. Now, this is kind of Freedom Weekend in America. Tomorrow's the 4th of July, so you might think, well, that's kind of a common thing to do, but actually, I've never done it. I've never preached a freedom sermon during 4th of July. I've just always stayed in my series, but I felt strongly that God wanted me to preach on freedom, and so instantly I started thinking, well, what do I preach on? Where do I go to think of freedom? What do I think of when I think of freedom? And of course, the very first thing I thought of was a movie.
And free men you are. What will you do without freedom?
So that's kind of where I came up. We're free. You know, in America, we live in land of the free. But what are we going to do with that freedom? And so I started to think of what kind of a sermon should we preach? And like I said, all across America, believe me, pastors are mounting their pulpits and they're preaching on freedom this week. It's not like I'm unique. There's a lot of different topics you can preach on for freedom. You can preach on the fact that freedom isn't free. That's always a rousing sermon. You can preach on America being founded on religious freedom. That kind of mixes civics lesson with sermons. It's always popular. You could even do this one. This one's kind of common as I was kind of looking around to see what other preachers are preaching on. I saw this several times. The topic was basically free to love whomever you want, regardless of race, nationality, creed, or sexual orientation. That's actually a sermon that's preached a lot more this year than it has been in the past. I didn't think any of those, though, were what God was calling me to preach on. And so I was thinking, I'm going to preach on freedom in Christ. Because I'm a big believer in grace, and I'm a big believer in freedom in Christ, and I was preparing to do that, but I just got a sense that that still wasn't what God was calling me to do. And so I started praying about that. I said, God, I don't know. You gave me a title, but you didn't give me a sermon. I really don't know where to go. And days are ticking by now. I have to come up with a sermon by Sunday. So where do I go? And I just felt led to go back and decide, where does my idea of freedom come from? You know, what do I mean by freedom? And so I thought, well, okay, I think I probably would go back to this document, the Declaration of Independence, because in it, you know, this is a document I love, and I love the story of it. There was a great play about it. I love the great play about it as well. And in this document, in the preamble, there's this great phrase that to me kind of defines what freedom is. It says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness." And I kind of felt a little bit like a kid who'd been given a homework assignment. Like, Jesus gave me a homework assignment. What does freedom mean to you? Where do you get your idea for freedom? I came up with this, and I was really proud of myself. I thought, this is it. This really kind of encapsulates all I think about when I think about freedom. This is where everything kind of springs from, this idea. And so I brought it back, you know, in my little study. I said, Jesus, this is what I think of when I think of freedom. I think of the fact that you, in your wisdom, gave us these rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And I just had this moment where, like, I felt like Jesus put his arm around me, and he said this, "I didn't know such thing." At that point, I really wasn't sure where to go, because I've always believed that's freedom. And what do you mean you didn't know such thing? What, you didn't give us life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness? And Jesus said no. And you know why? Because it's imperfect, and I don't do imperfect. And in fact, this is causing a lot of problems in our country today. And I stepped back and started thinking about the impact of this and how it's impacted our country. And it really is obvious that this is the problem that we're seeing. This is the actual part of that that's the problem. I mean, we wake up in America in 2016 and we have life. So if you wake up, you have life. That you've got that one in the bag. And we haven't had slavery here for 100 years, so we all have freedom. We don't have to worry about someone killing us for no reason. We don't have to realize for something, you know, don't have to worry about somebody throwing us in prison for no reason. We have those freedoms. We take those freedoms for granted. It's that third one that we don't always have. You know, it's this idea that we have a right to be happy, or at least we have a right to pursue happiness and whatever that takes us. We're allowed to chase after happiness. And you look at the TV shows, the movies, and the inspirational posters, follow your dream, be whatever you want. You know, if it makes you happy, go for it. And it's kind of a lot of advice that we got as children, and I think we're still giving to our children. Well, what makes you happy? You know, do you want to play soccer? Well, if that makes you happy, you should play soccer. And so we're always chasing after happiness. This pursuit of happiness is an obsession, really, with America. We focus on it, and it becomes the biggest thing in our lives. We need to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody has a right to be happy. And this is where we go. Now, of course, as these rights kind of get pushed out and we expand the boundaries of these freedoms, we suddenly find that we sometimes have a collision with other freedoms. And so some limitations in these freedoms have to exist. And usually in America, what we do for that is we let the Supreme Court decide. This smart-looking gentleman with his great mustache here, Oliver Wendell Holmes, said this. He said, look, you have freedom of speech, but that doesn't mean you can run into a crowded theater and shout fire. You know, we have to have some realistic expectations of what freedom really is. And everybody kind of looks at that and says, okay, that makes sense. We can all agree on that. Reasonable people can agree on that. I like what John Finch says even better. He gave this illustration. He says, look, I'm a big guy, and I'm standing here on stage, and I'm allowed to swing my arms about as much as I want. I have a freedom to do so. But if someone else were to stand on this stage, and I'm swinging my arms about, and I hit him in the face, I will quickly find that my right to swing my arm stops about where his nose begins. And I love this expression because it gives a nice, clear image. And frankly, I think the church in the last couple of years has been punched in the nose quite a lot lately. And this is all part of this chasing happiness. See, there's no place this is more clear. There's a lot of places this is clear, but there's no place this is more clear than the issues that have dominated the thought of Christian leaders over the past, let's say, 3 to 4 years, and that's about homosexual rights. See, it used to be in this country that homosexuality was actually illegal. In many states, there were sodomy laws that made it, or at least the acts of homosexuals, sexual acts, that made them illegal. And so that was for many, many years, 100 years in this country. And of course, churches all universally preached that it was sinful and wrong, and it was morally wrong. In fact, psychologists believed it was a psychological disorder, and it had to be treated like you treat any other kind of psychological disorder. And so that's how homosexuality was in this country for 100 years. But what happened was the homosexual community said, hey, you know what? This makes us happy. Pursuing this makes us happy. And we have, all men are endowed with this rights, that we have the right to be happy if we want to pursue this. And so we have the right to pursue that. And so America kind of started shifting its thinking on this and said, well, that's true. You know, we did say everybody has rights to pursue happiness. They're people too. So they have the right to pursue happiness as long as it's in the privacy of their own home. We're fine with it. And then that kind of pushed a little bit further because that wasn't enough. That didn't make them happy, as it turned out. And so then they started saying, well, we need to be accepted in society as well. We even need to be accepted in the military. And, you know, famously during the Clinton era, they came out with a don't ask, don't tell policy that America kind of all adopted about this whole homosexual thing. And that was okay for a while. But after a while, that wasn't enough either. They said, you know, we're still not happy. It's nice to be accepted, but we don't want to just be accepted. We want to be affirmed. We want society to say everything you're doing is fine, not just we'll let you do it, but it's fine. And specifically, they targeted on the one thing they could not do, and this was keeping them from happiness, and that was the issue of gay marriage. And so, you know, we want to be able to marry anybody we want. And we want that right. And it took several years, but recently with Supreme Court cases, because the Supreme Court justices changed and the new ones that came on had different views of the Constitution. And so they allowed it. And quickly, as soon as the Supreme Court of the United States allowed it, the states followed suits. And every state, or just about every state now, allows it, including the state of Pennsylvania. But at this moment, you see, the swinging fist of the homosexual agenda hit the church smack in the nose, because for centuries, the church had decided on marriage. In fact, it was only about 500 years ago when the King of England, one of the most powerful people in the world, had to get permission from the religious leader in another country in order to get permission to divorce his wife and marry the person he wanted to. So marriage was completely controlled. Even kings had to listen to the church. No more. Now in America, the church has to listen to the government. And they're saying, look, we're going to allow this. This is completely legal. Now, then we kind of hit this point where, hey, that, you know, this is my nose. You're hitting it with my fist. And so a stalemate kind of occurred, and this compromise was come up with, and that was, well, the state's going to marry them. That's fine. And many churches fell in line with that. Okay, we'll do it too. So where we are in America right now is if your church has the religious beliefs, because you have a right to religious freedom, that homosexuality is wrong and you can't have marriage, then we're allowed to not perform those marriages. But other churches will do them, and the state will do them. And as far as hiring practices or something inside of a church or any business, you have to go ahead and accept it as law. And this is kind of where we are. But it's not going to stay that way. I'm telling you, if you think you can take a deep breath and everything's solved here, you can't. Because I promise you, they're still not happy. It'll still be a case where they say, well, we're not happy because other churches are still condemning us and they're telling us we're sinful, and that doesn't make us happy. And so what we want is every church in the United States to say we're okay. And eventually they'll get enough votes and they'll push that next step in their pursuit of happiness. And this is going to happen probably unless trends change, unless something changes the tide. That's what's going to happen. We'll probably see in my lifetime if a church will not perform gay weddings, we'll have our tax-exempt status revoked, which actually won't matter to Spirit Chapel at all since we don't use tax-free status. But that'll happen. And then after that, the next thing, they'll open up the churches to lawsuits. And then it'd be very difficult for a church to continue on. And it'll probably happen. And even that won't satisfy them because they're always going to be pursuing the next thing to make them happy. And they don't understand that their happiness isn't being driven by this. It's actually being driven by something else. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But anyway, so this whole thing, this kind of passed before my eyes, and Jesus kind of said to me, I would have never created an imperfect system like that. It did not come from me. And so I thought, okay, now I don't know what to say, though, Lord, because my idea of what freedom is based on our great American documents, and you're telling me that's not even true. So now what do I do? And the Lord said, well, maybe you should read the Bible instead of looking on the internet and looking through American historical documents. Maybe the place to look for what freedom means is to look in the Bible. And so what did Jesus say about freedom? Now I'm going to stay in the red letter words of the Bible because I know I'm going to step on some toes today. And again, I always encourage you, mine got tromped on first, but this is where we went next. Because actually the Bible and Jesus says quite a lot about freedom. In fact, the very first thing he said officially was about freedom. Now this passage is from Isaiah, but the prophet's writing a prophetic word as though he is Jesus. So this is like Jesus gave him a prophetic word. And this is what he says. This would be like if Craigslist had an ad for Messiah, this would be it. He says, the Spirit of the Lord of God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and freedom to the prisoners. Now Jesus stood up and read this in the synagogue. This is how he announced when he was 30 years old that his ministry had begun. He took this scroll from Isaiah, he stood up and he read it. And when he was all done reading it, he folded it back up, handed it back to the attendant, and said this, "Today this prophecy has come true in your hearing." And he sat down. So this is how he announced that he was starting his ministry as Messiah. Now, in case you're wondering how the Jewish people feel about freedom of speech, the next thing they did was they picked up stones and tried to kill him. So much for freedom of speech in Jesus' day. But anyway, so that's how he starts. He says, I'm going to set the captives free. Well, what does that mean? What does it mean to set the captives free? And so I said, okay, this is cool, Lord, that you know this is definitely part of your mission. It wasn't just, oh, by the way, I'm going to also do this. It was part of his mission as Messiah was freedom. So how did you do this? Where does this go? And so the next verse he took me to was in John chapter 8. And this, now to set this up, he's walking along and he's teaching and he's had some conflicts with some Pharisees like he usually does. But then he gathers the disciples around him plus his followers. Now Jesus picked 12 disciples. We all know that. But at various times throughout his ministry, as many as 100 people would follow him around. You know, they said, we know who you are, you know, just hanging on his every word, waiting to see what he would do next. And so they followed him around. So he had people who believed in him as the Messiah. And that's important because these people he talked to now are believers. So you can listen to what he says to them, and you can say, well, he's saying it to me too, because you're a believer. And so Jesus is speaking to believers here, and this is what he says. He said, if you continue in my word, there's always an if there. When you see if, by the way, in a scripture, pay attention to it, because it's always a little bit of a if this, then that. So if you continue my word, then you are my disciples. That's pretty clear. If you're my disciples, you say you follow me, you need to follow me. You've got to continue in my word. And then he goes on and says, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. This is kind of an exciting passage, because what Jesus just says is, look, you need to listen to my words, because I'm going to give you a truth now. So the rest of the world, they're believing this lie, but I'm going to give you a truth. And nobody else knows that truth but you. And you're going to know this truth. This truth is so powerful, it is going to set you free. All right, that's a good setup. Okay, what's the truth? Lay it on me, Lord. What is this truth about freedom that I have to know that most of the world doesn't? And he says, here it is. Truly, truly, in case you didn't know where the truth was, he puts two of them in there. Truly, truly, verily, verily, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave of sin. It's not where I thought he would go. You know, when you kind of read him and you look at that, okay, it's not quite the truth I was expecting here. What does this have to do with freedom? I'm not clear on this. And you have to understand what Jesus just said. In fact, I would tell you that this is really kind of one of the core messages of Jesus' ministry. And if you don't catch this, nothing else he says is really going to make sense to you. It'll be interesting. It'll excite you sometimes and get you feeling good sometimes. But unless you understand this, it's not going to change you. You need to understand what he's saying here. Everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. By the way, who commits sin? Everyone. So everybody's gathered around, had to think, well, he's talking to me, because I commit sin. We commit sin all the time, and some of them are real private, no one knows about them, but we know, and we know we're committing it. Now, unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess I should say fortunately, but in America, we don't know what slavery is anymore. You know, we don't have slaves. In our lifetime, we've never seen slaves. And so when Jesus used the word like slave, we kind of have this conceptual idea, but I want to make sure it's not missed. And I'm going to apologize to some people who are just going to be offended as soon as I put the next slide up. I'm going to apologize in advance, but I just think it's really important that we don't misunderstand what Jesus is saying. This is what he's saying. He's saying sin makes you its bitch. Put it in prison terms for you. And that's a truth. And you know it's true because there's a sin in your life. There is something that you are doing that you can't stop doing. I know it because everybody has something they wrestle with, they fight with. And now why is that? You know, we're reasonably intelligent human beings. We're pretty disciplined. I mean, you guys are all here. You got up today on a Sunday morning. You obviously didn't want to on several levels. You wanted to sleep, but you got up. You got ready. We're disciplined. We can make ourselves do something we don't want to do because we know it's the right thing to do. It's how we get to work. It's how we get to school. That's how we persevere through certain problems. We're pretty good. We're intelligent. You know, we're disciplined. But yet there's that one thing in your life, at least one. For some of us, it's more, but at least that one thing in your life, there's that one thing, and no matter what, you can't stop doing it. It could be anything. It could be a temper. No matter what, I just get angry. I just can't stop it. Or maybe it's fear. Maybe you're afraid of things, and you're just terrified, and you wish you could make it go away, but you can't. Sometimes you're okay, then the fear will grab you. It could be an addiction. It could be drugs. It could be alcohol. It could be internet porn. There could be anything. It could be in a relationship that we kind of want to get rid of, but we can't seem to get rid of them. And no matter what, we always kind of fall back into that. Why is that? Why can't you stop that? Well, Jesus is telling you why. Because you're a slave to it. You just think you're free. You're on a chain, and you run as far as you want to go, but whenever sin wants you, it yanks that chain, and you come flying back. Listen, all across Pittsburgh area, this tomorrow, on Monday, people are going to wake up and go to our parks, and they're going to eat a lot of hamburgers and hot dogs, and they're going to drink a lot of beer. And sometime around 4 or 5, they're going to scream to have the band that's playing to play Freebird, because we always do that in Pittsburgh. I don't know why. And then there'll be fireworks and everything. And sometime between the time the fireworks end and the time they go to work the next morning, this is going to happen to a lot of them. Not all of them, but to a lot of them. They're going to find themselves kneeling on the floor in front of the toilet. And they're just going to be throwing up everything. They're going to be sick about it. And believe me, I don't know if you've had the pleasure of doing this, but if you ever have been, you know what I'm talking about. You're in a sweat, kind of a cold sweat. Things just spin around. You got this horrible headache. And your body just keeps just heaving. And even after you've got nothing left in you, it keeps going. It's one of the most miserable experiences. And I promise you, every one of those people, as they flush the toilet and watch all this stuff go away, they stare into that water swirling away and they say this, I will never do this again. But they will. They probably made that same promise last year. They may have made that same promise last month because they can't control it. It controls them. Anytime sin once, it whistles and they come running. And that's the way the sin is in our life. And that's what Jesus is saying. He says, listen, your freedom, you think you have freedom in your life? Your freedom is an illusion. You don't have freedom. You're a slave to sin. And if you don't understand that, you're not going to understand the rest of what Jesus has to say. But he says this very clearly, and we know it's true. We know this is true in our lives, that we are slaves to sin. And then he goes on, he says this, a slave doesn't remain in the house forever. Well, that's interesting, because what he's saying is this sin that you're a slave to, it's not even going to last. And we know that too, don't we? You know, when the sin calls you and you go, you know, do it and it's over, and you're like, man, it was such a short and no long-term benefit from it at all. And it's gone and we're still feeling bad about it. Sin, you know, the slave, it doesn't last forever. He said, but the son does. He said, I do. I last forever. I'll be here forever. So if the son makes you free, you will be free indeed. Not just for a little bit. He says, when I make you free, you're free. It's over. The sin's gone. You're free forever and ever, because that's how long it lasts when I do it. So, okay, that's really great. So how are you freed from the slavery of sin? Because he kind of tells us, sets that up, and he tells us that when he does it, this is what happens. But there he doesn't tell us how he frees us. You have to look at a different scripture to find that. And I'm jumping over to Matthew chapter 20. And now let me set this up. He's walking into a room and he's got his 12 disciples with him, just them. They're getting ready to sit down for dinner. And one of the moms pulls him aside. Psst, psst, Jesus, come here. And she has two sons who are disciples. And she says, my sons are the best. Because she's a good Jewish mother, you know, and this is what you do. And my sons are the best. And you should put one in your left hand and one in your right hand. You should make them your leaders, your lieutenants, your second and third in command. You'll do well if you do that. Be a good Jewish boy and do that, you know, because, you know, mothers do this. It's called kibitzing, and good Jewish mothers do this. And some of the other disciples hear this, and they get angry. So everybody's kind of angry at each other. And Jesus kind of ushers her out of the room and then calls everybody together. Like, hey, guys, come on. Come in here, take a knee. I got to tell you something. And then he goes and he tells them this. He says, look, listen, the Gentiles do this. They have a little bit of authority. They lord it over people and you hate it. Don't do that. He says, that's not how we are in the kingdom of heaven. That's not how it works in my Father's house, he tells them. He says, in fact, this, whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your bondservant. Now, this is an interesting word he uses there. Some biblical translations will translate that as slave. Some will translate it as servant. But the real translation is bondservant. And let me tell you what a bondservant is, because it's very interesting, the word Jesus uses here. In Jesus' day, there was no such thing as bankruptcy. If you owed a lot of money to somebody, you didn't get to go to the judge and say, well, my bad, can I sign a piece of paper and walk away? That's how it works in our country. In Jesus' day, you'd go to the judge with your creditor, and the judge would say, okay, you owe this guy money, pay him. And you'd say, I don't have that money. And the judge would say, you have two choices. You can either go to prison until you can pay him back, which is dumb, because if you're in prison, you'll never be able to pay him back, or you can become his bondservant. What a bondservant is a deliberate like a decision on your part to become a slave to that person. It's slavery, but it's unlike some like captured slaves or things from spoils of war, this was the person making the decision to become a servant for as long as it took to pay off the debt, because he couldn't pay it out of his own pocket. Now, sometimes the debt would be so great that they would never pay it off, and then they would just spend their whole lives as this person's slave. And what Jesus is saying, it's a bondservant. And what he's telling us is this, and look at the imagery that he conjures up here, because it's perfect. We're in sin. We've born in sin. We sin terribly. We did horrible things in our lives. And we made all kind of bad decisions. And we just came to Jesus all dirty and filthy. We could never repair that, ever. And the reason, the wages of sin, the Bible tells us, in other words, that the consequence of those sins is death. We should go to hell for what we've done. But Jesus said, you know what? I'm going to pay that instead. He didn't take the easy way out. He actually paid the debt. I'm going to pay your debt for you so you don't have to go to hell. And what he's saying is, when you understand what that is, what you're going to say is, I now have a debt to you, Jesus, that I can never pay. I can never repay Jesus for what he did. I can't. And because I can't, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make the willing decision to become your bondservant for life. Because it's the only way I can even come close to paying back the debt that I owe you. And Jesus is saying, if you come to me with that attitude, I will make you the first of the kingdom. Because I can trust you. You get it. You understand what the kingdom of heaven is all about. And so I can give you things in the kingdom of heaven to do because I can trust you. But if you don't, if you come here saying, hey, that was great, Jesus, what else you got? And holding out your hand and gimme, gimme, gimme. And all you want is more, more, more. And you don't want to pay, but you know, you don't have any gratitude at all. He says, I'm going to make you the least of the kingdom. Because I can't trust you with anything. Your heart's not changed. When your heart changes, you'll have a bondservant attitude towards me. And when you do that, then I can trust you with great things in the kingdom of heaven. Okay, but did he really just tell us that the way out of slavery is to become a bondservant? Because that simply seems to be like, the frying pan into the fire kind of a thing, right? We just changed one slavery for another, didn't we? Well, he goes on. In Matthew chapter 11, he gives us this imagery, and it starts off great. He says, come to me, all of you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Ooh, I like this verse. Okay, now we're back to the Jesus I know. This is great. I'm burdened and I'm trudging along with all these burdens. He says, come to me and I will give you rest. I like rest. Let me go there. And then he says, take my yoke. That's yoke, Y-O-K-E, not Y-O-L-K. It's not an egg. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. Like, wait a minute, yoke? What's a yoke? Well, that's that wooden thing they put on oxen and put them in a field and make them work. That's what a yoke is. Or sometimes you'll see this in especially like the Asian fishing villages or something. You'll see these women, they'll have this yoke. It's a wooden block that goes around their neck and across their shoulders, and they have lines coming on. They're carrying these big buckets and things, and they're trudging up the streets. And this is a yoke. And so Jesus said, hey, come take my yoke. It's like, wait a minute. I wanted freedom. And you're telling me that I'm supposed to be a bondservant? I'm supposed to take a yoke? You know, I've never heard the expression yoke of freedom. Have you? A yoke is like a symbol of slavery here. I don't understand, Jesus. I came to you for freedom, and you're saying, here's how you're going to get freedom. You're going to become my bondservant, and you're going to put on this a yoke. How about that? We'll start there. Like, Jesus, this makes no sense to me whatsoever. But this is the teaching of Jesus. Very simply, this is what he tells you. You are free to choose. You want freedom? That's your freedom. You can choose. You have two choices, and you can choose either one you want. And here they are. You can either be a slave to God, or you can be a slave to the world. There is no such thing as none of the above. And one of the biggest problems with Christians right now in America in this time and age is that we think that we can live in the none of the above category. Well, I don't really want to be a slave to Jesus, but I'm not really a slave to the world because he saved me. You know, I have his grace. So I'm not really a slave to the world either. I'm kind of in between there. And Jesus is saying, nope, that's not how it works. And he's very specific about this in Matthew chapter 20, chapter 6, verse 24. And in this case, he's teaching them and he says this. He says, look, no one can serve two masters. You can't. There's two masters going on. You can't serve them both. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be loyal to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now, some translations will say money there, but that's not what Jesus said. He said mammon. And mammon was a very specific choice for Jesus because in this day and age when the Romans were in charge, they had a polytheistic society where they had all these different gods, and there was a god of mammon. And if you wanted to be a servant of the god of mammon, you'd go and give a lot of money and sometimes do sacrifices and do tasks for the temple. But the god of mammon promised you this: I'll make you famous, I'll make you rich, and I'll make you powerful. The god of mammon was the god of the world. When Satan took Jesus to the top of the mountain and said, hey, if you bow down to me, I'll give you all of this, what he was saying is worship the god of mammon. Because I gave you all of this. That's mammon. So when Jesus said you can't serve God and you can't and mammon, what he was saying was you can't serve the God of heaven and you can't serve the God of this earth. You have to choose. There is no C, none of the above. You're going to be a slave to someone. You're either going to be a slave to God or you're going to be a slave to this world. And that's it. Those are your two choices. Forget this illusion. This is why I was telling them the first thing. These people are living a lie. They don't understand it. I'm going to give you a truth. The truth is your freedom on this earth is an illusion because sin owns you. And the only way out of it is if I own you. So why would we choose Jesus? Why would we do that? Well, I was going to come up with three reasons, but I know some of you are hard to convince, so I came up with four. Here's four reasons why you should choose Jesus. First of all, he knows you. He knows you better than anybody. In fact, anybody that you know in your life, going back as far as you want, he knows you better than all of them. Here in Psalm 139, he says, "While I was still in my mother's womb, you knew me. While I was still being put together right there, you knew who I was. In fact, before I drew my first breath," he says, "you knew how many breaths I would draw." He not only knew him then, he knew him in the future. He says, "You knew me from before I began to the end of my life here on earth. Instantly, you knew me. You've known me that long. You know me completely and totally." So unlike other servants, you know, if you think, "Well, I don't want to be a servant of a person because that person would be mean to me and cruel to me." And God says, "But I know you. I know everything about you. I know exactly what it is that you want to do in life, which will make you truly satisfied and complete. I know that. I know that better than you do. And so when I'm going to give you tasks, I'm going to give you tasks that are light, as we said, that my burden's light, because you're going to enjoy doing them. Because I know exactly what talents and abilities and gifts you have. And I'm going to put you in positions to use those. And as you use those, you're going to be happy. So don't worry. Yes, there'll be work involved here, but you're going to love it. You're going to really enjoy it because it's going to be work you were created to do. That's why you need to choose me. Second of all, he cares about you. I love this scripture in Psalms. He's because sometimes we say, "Boy, you know, get bitter and you get tired. You get alone, maybe, and you're in a room and you're crying, and you wonder if anybody knows." He said, "Jesus, do you even know?" And he says, "Look, I have captured your tears in a bottle. I have not only seen you cry, I have saved every tear you cried because it's precious to me. I want to remember all the things you cried about. I'm never going to forget that. I care about you. I care about you deeply. Every tear you've ever cried, I haven't just heard, I've kept. You're precious to me. Everything about you is precious to me," he says. And he also says this in Isaiah. He says, "Look, you see that woman nursing her child there? Do you think that woman would ever, ever forget the son that's nursing at her breast?" He said, "Let me tell you something. She might, but I won't." That's how deep it goes with me. Your own mother will forget your name before I will. "I'll never forget you," he says. "In fact, I inscribed you on the palm of my hands." He doesn't say I inscribed your name. It's not a tattoo. He says, "I inscribed you on the palm of my hands. Your image is on the palm of my hands. I can look at it whenever I want. You're so precious to me. I've kept you with me at all times. And I will never forget you. Your mom might, but I won't. I will never forget who you are. I'll never forget about you. You can trust me," he says. "I care about you." And third, this is a really important one. God protects what's his. And if you're struggling in bondage of some kind, if you've got an addiction and you're thinking, "Man, I don't know how I ever get out of this," here's how you get out of it. Here's the only way out of it, really. Because you're a slave to that addiction. And you went out of the addiction, here's what you do. You give yourself to Jesus. Because God protects what's his. And if you want to see the armies of heaven gather and muster the forces and get ready to attack, you just watch what happens when Satan tries to lay a hand on somebody that is owned by God. God protects his own. In Job, we see this. God's to heaven, and the devil comes by to visit, and God's kind of saying, "Hey, did you see my servant Job?" In Job chapter 1, he says, "Did you see my servant Job? Look at him. He's blameless. He's great. Isn't he such a great guy?" Of course, knowing that Satan's going to hate Job. And Satan says this, "Well, why not? Why wouldn't he be? You have made a hedge about him and his house and all he has on every side." He says, "You have built a wall of protection around him and I can't get to him. No wonder he loves you." Listen, God still builds hedges of protection around those he loves. And if you've given yourself over to God and you really, truly mean it, it's not just something that you did in a moment, I'll do it, but I'll take it back later. If you really mean it, you can pray this prayer around yourself. "God, today I'm going into an area where I know I'm going to be tempted. Build a hedge of protection around me." And just watch what happens. It'll be almost hysterical, the quote-unquote coincidences that will happen to pull the temptation away from you. You're walking with the protection of God because God protects those that are his. That's why we want to be his. And finally, God takes care of his own. Right after he tells about God and mammon, Jesus goes on to say this. Look, this is the reason I'm telling you, don't worry about your life. You guys are worried about what's happening here on our earth because you're worried about mammon. And forget it. Drop it. I've got this, he says. He said, look at the birds of the air. They don't sow, they don't reap, they don't gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not more precious than birds? I promise you they're not inscribed on his palm, he says. You're more precious to God than the birds, and he takes care of them. What makes you think he's not going to take care of you? He says, my Father knows everything you need. Everything. You don't have to worry about this. You can just stop worrying. See, this is where you get to lay that burden down. Just stop worrying. I've got this. Here's what you have to worry about. The kingdom of heaven. That's it. If you focus on the kingdom of heaven, I'll take care of everything else. He says, because after all, you're doing all this worrying, and what good's it? You can't even add a single hour to your life. In fact, worrying all the time will be taking hours off of your life. You're not going to add anything. And he says, I've got this. Jesus cares for his own. This is why when we have a choice, it should be one of these no-brainers, and yet we're always trying to find a way out. We're trying to say, well, I don't really want to become a bondservant to Jesus. Can you just deliver me from sin and let me stay here and just live my life and have fun, and then I'll come back to heaven and then we'll do this thing. Jesus says, no. That's not the way it works. Because if you want to be free of the sin of this world, you can only do it if you become a bondservant to me. This is what Jesus says. Here's your choice. God or mammon. That's it. So many choices you have. And we've seen in our lives people who have chased mammon and done very well with it. And you can even be jealous of these people sometimes because it seems that they've got everything. But this is the one thing Jesus said when he says, the slave does not stay forever, but I do. He's saying this, eventually mammon will leave you. Because mammon is simply trying to string you along and then it'll kill you and leave you on the side of the road. And we've seen this happen over and over and over again in our society. I don't care how great the person is, how famous they are. You watch these actors and actresses and thinkers of the day and great politicians or businessmen, and you watch them chase after mammon, and they always end up the same way, it seems. Some of you may know, a few years ago, Steve Jobs passed away. Steve Jobs, at the time, had created, with the help of others, of course, but he had created the most successful company the world had ever seen. At the time of his death, Apple Computers, or Apple Technology, was the richest company that the world had ever seen. They had more cash in the bank than many countries have in a bank. It was huge. And yet Steve Jobs, of course, died tragically. Now, because of who he was and how important he was, and I mean, people worshipped him quite literally. I mean, if you ever saw any of his keynote speeches at the events, I mean, you watch these people line up and watch their rapt attention to every word he said. I mean, they treated him literally like a god. And Apple Computer made him take these tests every year because he was very, very important to the company. And because of that, they were able to detect a metastasization of pancreatic cancer in his life very early. Now, there's a couple of different kinds of pancreatic cancer. He had the non-aggressive kind. And the doctor came to him and said, look, we can operate on this and we can get rid of it. And you have like about a 90-some percent chance of a full total recovery. And Steve Jobs said no. Instead, he went off and met with a holy man, and he came with a special diet that the guy gave him because he said, what you need is to improve your chi. You know, you're strong enough to fight this off, and don't worry about it. And so he went and did that for 9 months, and his cancer got so much worse that eventually he gave up on that. He went back to the doctor. He says, forget it. I'll do the operation. He says, well, it's too late now. This has become very aggressive now, and it's not going to make it. And so Steve Jobs watched, dying alone, pretty much, while his company stayed up there because mammon was done with him. And it used him up and it cast him aside. It never fails when you chase after mammon that eventually it's done with you. And when it's done with you, it'll hurt you and leave you. And that's what happens. But God says, I never will. And so, basically, Jesus says this, and we have to understand it's one of the most important things that he taught us. He says, you have a choice. Your choice is this, pursuit of happiness, or pursuit of holiness. If you become my bondservant, I'll make you holy. And you will find rest, and you'll find satisfaction, and you'll find fulfillment. Or you can chase the pursuit of happiness, and eventually it will use you up and leave you on the side of the road. The choice is yours. Would you please pray with me?